You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
If you could sort of summarize Acts chapter 18, I would say that it is how to live as light in a dark world. And really, Luke, the author of the book of Acts, gives us five things that we should be mindful of or remember as we are trying to be that. So let's begin in Acts chapter 18, verse 1. Then Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. If you recall, last week we studied how Paul went to really the center of Western civilization in the ancient world and had sort of an unremarkable impact on those people there in Athens. And yet, here we are thousands of years later reading this account and drawing principles for how we can make an impact for God. And so Paul moves on from Athens, which was nearby Corinth, a neighboring city. And so here's a map. As you can see, that is the Peloponnese. And Athens is a little bit east of Corinth. And so what's interesting is that Corinth was a popular city because there was an isthmus that actually connected the slipway between those islands there and the sea. And so a lot of times, if you were going to go west, you had to travel around the southern tip of Greece in order to get around. And those were dangerous waters. It was very perilous. And so what they would actually do is they would take ships up to the isthmus, which was a small little area right there, about 1 mile long. And they would take ships and put wood boards over top of the land, grease it with animal fat, and they would take these large cargo ships and haul them over land onto the other side. And this would take several days. And as you can imagine, lots of manpower. And that's what basically put Corinth on the map. It was a seaport city that existed in large part because so many ships came through this isthmus. Today, they actually cut a channel on this isthmus that brings through these large cargo ships. And you would think, okay, why go through all of this trouble to haul a ship over land? Well, it actually saved 200 miles of travel by going through the slipway. So Corinth became really the second leading city in the ancient world at this time, next to Athens. And we see in a variety of ways that it was kind of the intellectual center, just like Athens was in the ancient world. So ancient Corinth was renowned as obviously a wealthy port city. People would come here, they would spend money, they would do trading. It boasted one of the largest populations in the ancient world. Obviously, it didn't rival some of the largest cities today that we have that are in the millions, but Rome was like the largest city in the world, and it was about 1 million people. So Corinth, at its zenith, was about 700,000 people, so pretty close to where Rome was. It was regarded as a center of intellectual activity because it was right there near Athens, and so a lot of the ideas that were coming from Athens sort of radiated out, and since Corinth was nearby, they were constantly on top of all of the new ideas and philosophies that were being discovered. And it was also famed for its annual Isthmian Games, second only to the Olympics, but it would actually draw people from around the world to compete. It contained a large pantheon of gods with its principal temple that was dedicated to Aphrodite, the goddess of love. And worship of Aphrodite included going to the temple and actually sleeping with temple prostitutes. Parents would take young girls and they would dedicate their daughters to a life of service to Aphrodite, where they would live at the temple. And so these women, these young women, would live at the temple and serve by day, and then at night they would roam the streets of Corinth living as prostitutes. And if some of these young women happened to get pregnant, the priestess would perform a termination of the pregnancy that was very crude, obviously. And so a lot of these young women live very short lives. It was also one of the most immoral cities in the ancient world. This place would make Las Vegas look like Disneyland, right? Seamen would come and dock here at Corinth. And, you know, some of these guys would be out for, you know, months at sea, and they would come to Corinth with a pocket full of cash. And so they would go and they would party for several days, and they'd be like, you know what? Since we're in Corinth, why don't we do a little bit of worship at the temple? And so it was renowned as a city that was steeped in immorality. In fact, the Romans said that the city was so immoral that you even if you visited the city, you would be polluted. They actually invented a verb that is based on this word, Corinth, to Corinthianize, meaning to commit immorality. So this sort of gives you a little bit of a flavor of what Corinth was like. It was a city that was marked by anarchy and self-indulgence. You know, if you wanted to live a life of hedonism, if you wanted to experience the maximal amount of pleasure, this would be a place that you would go. It would be your first destination in the ancient world. And you would think that people who are living this kind of lifestyle, who are inundated with immorality, hedonism, sensuality, a life just driven by pleasure, that these people would be very, very unreceptive to God. And yet, from what we can gather in not only the book of Acts, but also in 1 Corinthians, a book that Paul wrote to this city, large numbers of people actually responded to the message of Jesus Christ. And so this brings us to our first reminder that often the people who seem furthest from God actually show the least resistance to the gospel. That seems a little bit counterintuitive, where you see people living a life of just sensuality, living a life that is based on pleasure, and you think to yourself, these people are not interested in God. And yet, what we find, though, is that a lot of times when you live a life like that, your helplessness actually rises faster as you pursue a trajectory of unchecked immorality. And that's exactly what was happening here. Many of these people had lived their lives just for pleasure, thinking that that was the thing that was going to make them happy, and then they found that their lives were empty. They felt unfulfilled. You know, many of us in this room have pursued a similar lifestyle, thinking that's the thing that's going to actually make me happy. I'm just going to live for pleasure. Because, you know, I don't know what meaning my life really has. And so if this is the only life that I have, then I should experience as much pleasure as I possibly can, thinking that that's actually going to lead to happiness, when in reality, it leads to emptiness. And you would think that when you are living a life like this, that you are the furthest away from God. But in reality, it's often that we are closest to meeting God when we're at that place. I think about my own life, where I thought living for pleasure, doing all of these things would actually make me happy. And I found myself doing things that I couldn't even imagine myself doing. And it was in that moment when my life was shattered, when I felt a sense of emptiness in my heart, that God came to me and he pursued me. And that's exactly what this story tells us. Is that when you feel furthest away from God, God is actually near pursuing you. That he's allowing our need level to rise by pursuing a life apart from him. Well, it says that here he became acquainted with a Jewish person named Aquila, born in Pontus, who had recently arrived from Italy with his wife Priscilla. They had left Italy when Claudius Caesar deported all the Jews from Rome. So Acts introduces us to two people who actually become very prominent figures in the New Testament, Priscilla and Aquila. And we get a little bit of biographical information about these two. It says that when Claudius Caesar decided to create this policy to banish the Jewish people, that they had to flee Italy, and that's how they actually ended up at Corinth. Now, this is very interesting because this is one of those cases where we see history actually snapping together perfectly with what we read in the Bible. Over and over again, we've studied the book of Acts and have seen how critics of the Bible have questioned the historicity of the Bible and point to how Luke was really sort of a hack historian. And yet, time and time again, not only archaeology, but history has vindicated the book of Acts. For instance, Suetonius, who was a famous Roman historian, writes in his book, The Life of Claudius. He says, as the Jews were making constant disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, he banished them from Rome. So we can infer from this that these were not Jewish people who were devout Jews that, you know, had resisted Christianity, because it says that they actually were followers of Crestus, which is probably a misspelling of Christus. So these were likely Jewish Christian believers who were spreading the news of Jesus throughout the city of Rome. And Claudius, who was the Caesar at the time, was very, very nervous and decided to banish all of the Jews and the Christians from Rome, and they got scattered throughout the world. Now, this is sort of a side note, sort of a side quest here, but it's kind of interesting. We know that Paul never actually went to Rome and planted a church there. He tells us that in the book of Romans. What I think actually happened here, and there's pretty good evidence for this, is that when the early church began in Acts chapter 2, we get a list of all the different people who came to Jerusalem to worship on the day of Pentecost. And it includes Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, and parts of Libya near Cyrene, and visitors from Rome. And so there must have been Roman Jewish people there at Pentecost when Peter was preaching, and some of them came to Christ. And they stayed there for some months until in Acts chapter 8, they were driven out by the great persecution. And so likely those people from Rome who became believers in Jesus went back to Rome and planted a church there. And that's probably how Aquila and Priscilla became believers in Jesus. It also said that Paul lived and worked with them, for they were tent makers just as he was. So he actually had a lot in common with them. Now, we think of tents and we think of uncomfortable, sleepless nights in the rain, misery, right? But actually, tents were very, very common in the ancient world, where people were living as nomads throughout the desert areas and the semi-arid areas of the ancient Near East. And these tents are not like our modern day tents that are very, very light. They were actually leather. And so it required a tremendous amount of skill to sew these leather tents. And you could make a large profit from this. So Paul, because he was a rabbi, actually had to learn a trade that was required of all students who were following rabbis. They were learning theology, but they also had to have a trade. And so Paul took up tent making. And so he would travel from city to city, and he would work as a tent maker by day to be able to support himself, because the church may not have been able to afford paying his salary. And so he would work as a tent maker by day, and then in the evening he would clean himself up and then go and preach the good news of Jesus Christ. And this actually allowed him to support himself and to avoid some of the suspicions that people had about him and his motives when he entered a city. In one case, we know that Paul, Paul renounced his right to receive support. And in this case, it was because the Corinthians actually accused him of preaching for money. There are a group of people who are kind of like TED Talk speakers of the ancient world, and they would travel from city to city, and they would bring new ideas, philosophy, politics, various different new ideas, practical wisdom to different cities. And there was also this expectation that you would pay these speakers. And so when Paul arrived in Corinth, the Corinthians mistook him for a sophist, one of these people, and said, oh, well, this guy, he's just preaching for money. And so Paul wanted to make sure that he was able to differentiate himself from all of these other people by supporting his own needs as a tent maker. In fact, there were some cases where he was so adamant about this that he wouldn't even accept a free meal. He talks about this in his book, 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 8, where apparently some of the people in that city were accusing him of preaching for money. And so he refused to take anything from these people, not even a meal. Can you imagine like having the Apostle Paul over to your house and, you know, he sits down and you're like, here's this, you know, wonderful dinner that we provided for you. And he like pulls out a $20 bill, lays it on the table. And you're like, what's that for? He's like, it's for dinner. You're like, no, seriously, that it's on us. You're our guest. Thank you for sharing the good news of Jesus with us. You can keep your money. He's like, no, actually, I insist. And he's like, if you don't take my money, I'm going to have to unfortunately leave. Be like, all right, then. You know, like, what are you supposed to do in that situation? But see, Paul wanted to make sure that people did not think that he was just like one of these sophists, that he was peddling the message of Jesus Christ, something of such great importance for money. And this takes us to our second thing that we need to remind ourselves of when we are being a light to a dark world, which is that our lives must withstand scrutiny from the world. You know, today you turn on the news, you get on Yahoo News, you get on the internet, whatever it is that you, however you consume your media, right? And it's not surprising to hear of some pastor or some Christian who is ahead of some organization being caught in a scandal, especially involving money. Think of all of the pastors that you have read about over the last few years who are getting busted out for living these lavish lifestyles on the backs of poor people who are contributing their hard-earned money to the church. Driving around in luxury vehicles, living in palatial mansions, while many of their members are living in utter poverty. That's a scandal. And no wonder so many people in our culture today question the institution of the church. No wonder so many people distrust Christian pastors. You know, when I first came around years and years ago, I remember standing in the driveway where we used to meet on 16th, right before CT. And the senior pastor of our church came up in this 15-year-old Honda Civic with its muffler rattling on the ground. And he drove up onto the driveway and it just scraped, you know, on the driveway. And I just remember thinking to myself, who is this guy, right? And why is he driving this car? And so I got to know him a little bit better, and he actually ended up driving this car for 5 more years. One time, he actually took me to the convenience store. And so I jumped in the car with him, and I just looked at his car. I was like, this thing sucks. He's like, what do you mean it sucks? He's like, it's got air conditioning. It's got a CD player. It goes 0 to 60 in eventually. And he's like, the best thing about this car is that it actually gets 35 miles to the gallon. He drove that car 2 more years until it finally sprung a gas leak. And I remember getting into his car because we would get lunch at that point, and his car was just reeking of gasoline. I was like, dude, you cannot drive in this car. It is so dangerous. And he's like, no, 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 it's fine. It's just a minor leak. And he's like, honestly, I actually did the calculation and it still gets 30 miles to the gallon. I was like, but the problem is your car is a rolling Molotov cocktail, dude. This thing is not safe. And so, you know, there were times where, you know, I would question things like his judgment, right? But the one thing I never questioned was his motives for why he was doing what he was doing. I knew it wasn't for money. And it's funny because I was actually hanging out with him recently, and he's still this way, right? Where he just holds on to things that really should not be held on to. And I told him, I was like, hey, you know, at some point it's okay to buy a nicer version of certain things that last, and that way you don't have to buy the cheapest version 10 different times. I was like, not everybody is pathologically frugal like you. And he looked at me, he's like, I like to say thrifty. Anyway. You know, when you think about what Jesus tells us, he says, you are the light of the world. Notice he doesn't say you should be the light of the world. He says, you are the light of the world. And then he follows that up in Matthew 5, verse 16, where he says, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good deeds and glorify God in heaven. So the reason why we should live as lights is so that the watching world, living in darkness, the lost world that we live in, can see our lives, and it can give us a platform to be able to share the good news of Jesus that people desperately need to hear. And so when we live our lives, we need to be conscious of how we are representing Jesus. Because often people are associating who Jesus is with how we live our lives, unfortunately. And so, what do you like at work? Do you work hard? Do you make your coworkers' lives easier? Or are you lazy? Are you somebody that everybody's just like, I hate working with this guy. He's terrible. He makes our lives miserable. You know, Paul says, whatever you do, work with all of your heart as if working for the Lord. You know, would you do the same thing for the God of the universe? You know, some of us at work, we sit around and we just complain all the time. You know, what is Paul say in Philippians 2, verse 14? He says, do everything without grumbling so you may shine like stars in the sky as you hold firmly to the word of life. You know, when people look at our lives, it should signal to them something is actually different about this person in a positive way. And in addition to that, we should also have integrity and honesty. I love this passage in Titus 2:10 where Paul instructs Titus to tell these believers to live this life of honesty and integrity so that they will adorn the teaching of God our Savior in every way. You know what it means to adorn something, right? You get like a beautiful Christmas tree and then you take it home. You know, the idea is to put ornaments on it, to adorn it, to make it even more beautiful, to make it its appearance even more beautiful, right? But if you did something like this, that's the opposite of adorning, right? It's taking away or distracting from the beauty of this tree. Or if you hang different ornaments on there, of Nick Cage and weird teeth on there. You're like, this is actually making this Christmas tree look horrible. It makes it look ugly, right? So in the same way, our lives should actually adorn or make the good news of Jesus Christ even more attractive. And we should do so based on our integrity. I've said this before in this venue, but the number one word that people associate with Christians in our country is hypocrite. Hypocrite. And they're not that far off. I remember years ago when I was a teenager, many years ago, I would visit this store, and I'm a little reluctant to mention what the store's name is because it's going to date me, but it was called Blockbuster Video. It's now defunct, but back in my day, you would have to go to a video store. It wasn't even like a red box. You would have to go into a video store and check out movies. And so I would come to this video store about once a week to go get new movies, and I noticed that the girl there was kind of cute. And so, you know, I decided I was going to go over there and spit some game. You know? Yeah. And so over the course of a few weeks, like, we started talking. And I remember one time we were hanging out, and she, like, shared with me. She's like, hey, listen, I just need to let you know, like, I'm a pretty, like, committed follower of Jesus. I'm a Christian. And I really take that seriously. And I'm like, you too? Right? Like, I would say whatever I needed to say, right, to try to get with this girl. And so she would be like, listen, I really want you to come and visit my church with me. And I'm like, yeah, that's cool. We should do that. But I would never go. And so finally, she was like, listen, you've promised to come with me several different times, and it's clear you're just not that interested in this. You need to know that if you want to date me, if you want to be with me, like, you have to, like, actually take an interest in this. Otherwise, we're done. I was like, whatever, right? And so we didn't see each other after that. But it made an impression on me. Like, here I am many years later talking about this story, because it was the first time that I had ever met a Christian that actually stuck to her convictions. And so, what about you? Is your life a life of integrity? Is it a life of honesty? Is it a life of conviction where people look at your life and think, there's something different about this person? They're willing to stand up for things that actually matter and to act differently and not just act like everyone else in our world. Verse 4 says, each Sabbath found Paul at the synagogue trying to convince the Jews and Greeks alike. And after Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul spent all of his time preaching the word. So if you can remember from last week, Silas and Timothy got sort of separated from Paul, and they ended up joining back up together. And apparently Silas and Timothy in this time had gathered some money to be able to pay for Paul and his expenses so that he could be free to share the news of Jesus Christ freely. And so they must have brought the money from Macedonia and actually allowed Paul to be able to devote himself completely to this work. It tells us in Philippians 4, verse 15 and 16, he says, you were the only ones who gave me financial help when I first brought you the good news and then traveled on from Macedonia. No other church did this. And so they must have come up with a collection and given it to Paul when he was in Corinth. Well, Paul testified to the Jews that Jesus was the Messiah, but when they opposed and insulted him, Paul shook the dust from his clothes and said, your blood is upon your own heads. I'm innocent. From now on, I'm going to go and preach to the Gentiles. So this comes from Luke chapter 10, where, if you can remember, Jesus sent out his followers in pairs on a mission to preach the good news of the kingdom and to heal the sick. And he instructed his followers, he said, listen, if you don't get a hearing, if you don't get a reception from the people in the city, what you need to do is walk to the edge of the city, and I want you to shake your tunic, your cloth, of all of its dust. And that is an indication that you have done what you could in your conscience to make sure that these people knew about the gospel of the kingdom. And two, it was also a sign of their self-condemnation. And so Paul said, you know, from now on, I'm going to go to the Gentiles. And so he didn't continue to labor in this synagogue. He decided to go and find more receptive people. And this brings us to our next reminder, which is that we need to move on if people aren't receptive to Christ. And there are a few reasons for this. First of all, it shows respect for their free will. We've talked about how God respects our choice. And in fact, if God decided to force us or compel us, that it would actually nullify our freedom and our choice. And so in the same way, we can't keep pressing on when people have clearly said to us, listen, I don't want to hear this anymore. We need to respect people's choice and their free will. Secondly, battering people with the message of Jesus might actually inoculate them from the truth. You know, if you go and get your flu vaccine, like some of the different side effects from that can be like soreness, pain at the injection site. You might have like a low-grade fever, a headache. And what is that? What is that? It's your body essentially fighting off this small amount of virus that's entered your system, and it's inoculating you from influenza. And so in the same way, when we hear the message of Jesus Christ, it's very polarizing. You know why? Because it's good news that Jesus came and died for our sins to bring us forgiveness. But the problem is, the only way to receive that forgiveness is humbling ourselves and admitting that we need what he is offering. That's the hard part. And so when you hear that over and over again, when you're being confronted with how you have a problem and that you are guilty before God, if you hear that over and over again, it gets really, really easy to start to then dismiss it. And so you can actually do more harm than good by continuing to batter people with the message of Jesus. And here's the thing. Maybe your job wasn't to lead this person to Christ. Maybe your job was to take this person who was maybe like negative 15 all the way to a negative 4. Because usually God uses a variety of different people to help lead people to him. And so a lot of times we have our part to play in that process. And you know what? It's actually really I don't even know how to describe it, arrogant, I guess, to think that we are the ones who are actually responsible, ultimately responsible to lead people to Christ. God uses a variety of people over the course of years. And so that doesn't mean that we need to give up on these people. We need to trust that God is sovereign and will use a variety of people in this person's life. And the best thing that we can do is pray for them. And so focusing our attention on the unreceptive actually may prevent us from seeing the people who are right in front of us that are actually open. Then Paul left and went to the home of Titius Justus, a Gentile who worshiped God and lived next door to the synagogue. Okay, think about this. So he goes over to the synagogue. They're like, we don't want to hear any of this. And then he goes next door to this guy's house, Titius Justus. That's like, you know, taking like opening up a taco stand in the parking lot of a Mexican market. And what happens? We find that Crispus, the leader of the synagogue, and everyone in his household believed in the Lord. And many others in Corinth also heard Paul. Who also heard Paul became believers and were baptized. And so in this unexpected turn of events, what ends up happening? Day by day, Crispus, who was the original synagogue leader that was dismissing Paul and everything he had to say, was hearing the message of Jesus. And eventually, he places his faith in Jesus. And he's such an influential person that it says that many people in the city became believers. So hundreds, if not thousands, of people come to Christ in this city. So this is a wonderful outcome. One night, the Lord spoke to Paul in a vision and told him, "Don't be afraid. Speak out. Don't be silent, for I'm with you, and no one will attack you or harm you, for many people in this city belong to me." So you would think that even though Paul is seeing all of this success in Corinth at this point, that he would feel energized by this, but in fact, he felt afraid. You know, we can reconstruct maybe what he was thinking. Possibly he feared persecution here because God says, "Don't be afraid. No one's going to attack or harm you." I don't know if you've been with us through the book of Acts, but it's kind of like a broken record. Paul goes into a city, he goes to a synagogue, he gets beaten, and then he goes to the Gentiles, and there's receptivity. It's like over and over again. And some of the worst ones where he was persecuted were chapters that we just read. In Acts chapter 14, he goes to Lystra, and he gets thrown out of the city, and they stone him outside of the city. He is so critically injured that people think he's actually dead. And yet he stands up and just walks back into the city. And then we read about this a couple weeks ago in Acts chapter 16, where he was beaten with rods and thrown into a dungeon in the city of Philippi. And so you can imagine that even though Paul was this tough person, we often envision him as this just person with just laser focus, undeterred, resilient. Even he was afraid at times. You know, he probably was dealing with legitimate trauma that he experienced from all of these beatings and persecutions going to all these cities. And so I really think that this is something that's encouraging for us. Because when we look at the life of Paul, it's easy to think that he's sort of a fictional character. That he's this kind of guy who just keeps going and never stops and is undeterred. But even he felt fear. And so there are times where you might feel fear, times where you might feel intimidated. And you can take courage that even the Apostle Paul felt that as well. The second thing is, maybe he felt intimidated to share Jesus with the Corinthians. God had to assure him. He says, "For many people in this city belong to me." What is he saying here? What he's telling Paul is, even though outwardly these people don't seem like they're very, very receptive, you don't see things the way I see things. You're a human. You see the outward appearance of people, but I see the heart. I can see beyond the layers of intellectual arguments and resistance to what's actually happening in people's hearts. And so he assured Paul, "Look, these people, they need to know about my son Jesus." And part of this was probably that Paul felt a little bit insecure. Remember, this city was actually a very prominent city. It was a city that was wealthy. It was filled with intellectuals. It was probably like a Silicon Valley. Imagine going to Silicon Valley, you know, or to Berkeley, California, and trying to like win people to Christ there. That would be kind of intimidating, wouldn't it? Well, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 1 through 4, he says, "When I came to you, I didn't come with eloquence or human wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God, for I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness with great fear." So the Corinthians were a proud people. They were proud because they were part of a prominent city. Julius Caesar actually had rebuilt the city in 46 AD. And Paul must have looked at this and thought, "These people in Corinth are just going to reject me. And yet he resolved only to preach the good news of Jesus Christ because he knew in that message contained the power of God. And so this leads us to our next thing that we should remember is we're trying to be lights in a dark world, which is don't be afraid to share the good news about Jesus. The good news about Jesus undermines all human pride. It insists that there is nothing that you can contribute to your salvation. And no wonder so many people in Corinth who were prominent and wealthy and well-respected rejected the message of Jesus Christ. And yet there were some, many, who were not of that class who did respond. And so don't be afraid to share the good news about Jesus. You know, there are going to be people that you look at and you think, this person is just pursuing a life of pleasure. Or here is this graduate student. I mean, you know, I'm at Columbus State or I'm getting my associates. Like, who am I to like try to reach somebody like that? You'd be surprised. Because you know what? It's not about your wisdom. It's not about your intellect. It's not about your charisma that ultimately leads people to Jesus. It's about the power of God. And I've seen people who are PhD students, candidates, who now are running labs at OSU, who are devoted, committed followers of Jesus, who outwardly you would look at and think, oh, this person has their life together. They would never be interested in anything like this, but who had a deep longing to know the creator of the universe. And so Paul stayed there for the next year and a half teaching the word of God. So Paul decided, you know, I'm going to take some time and train some of the people here. But when Gallio became proconsul of Achaia, some Jews rose up together against Paul and brought him before the governor for judgment. This, again, is another really interesting historical piece here because Gallio, according to critics of the Bible, could not have been a proconsul of Achaia. Because Roman provinces were divided between imperial and senatorial provinces. And so clearly, Gallio could not have been a proconsul. Because proconsuls ruled senatorial provinces while legates ruled imperial provinces. So they're like, oh, Luke's followers must have actually included this in there. But they were ignorant about Corinth and its status. But the thing is, these provinces often switched back and forth between imperial and senatorial provinces. And in the 1900s, an archaeological finding actually corroborates what we find in the book of Acts. This is called the Delphi or Gallio inscription that dates back to AD 51/52, which is exactly when Gallio was proconsul of Corinth. And it also states, not that he was a legate, but what? That he was a proconsul, just as Luke says. Another mark of authenticity. Well, they accused Paul of persuading people to worship God in ways that are contrary to our law. But just as Paul started to make a defense, Gallio turned to Paul's accusers and said, "Listen, you Jews, if this were a case involving some wrongdoing or serious crime, I'd have reason to accept your case. But since it's merely a question of words and names of your Jewish law, take care of it yourself. I refuse to judge such matters." And then he threw him out of the courtroom. He's like, "I don't care about your theological debates." And the crowd then grabbed Sosthenes, who then became the leader of the synagogue after Crispus probably left, and they started to beat him right there in the courtroom. So they're pissed because they thought that they actually had a case, but then Gallio throws it out. And so what do? They jump him right there in the courtroom. And then we read that Gallio paid no attention at all. He was indifferent. You know, you can imagine this scene. They're all, you know, stomping Sosthenes, and Gallio's like, "Next." And what's interesting is that later on, we find out in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 1, the introduction to the letter that Paul writes to them, This is the letter from Paul, chosen by the will of God to the apostle of Christ Jesus, and from our brother Sosthenes. Well, well, well. Sosthenes actually becomes a believer in Jesus. Again, it takes a little bit of imagination, but you can sort of envision Sosthenes getting the crap beat out of him, and he's just sitting there laying on the ground, bloodied, and Paul walks up to him, you know, helps him up off the ground, dusts him off, and he's like, well, it looks like that didn't turn out too well, did it? And eventually, he ends up persuading Sosthenes to come to Christ as well. And then we see in verse 18, Paul stayed in Corinth for some time after that. It's interesting that Corinth is probably the one place where Paul stayed the longest out of all the churches that he planted. And I believe that it's because the people of Corinth had a lot of problems. They had a lot of baggage. And so our final reminder as we're working and being a light to a dark world is that love is patient. In Paul's famous chapter, 1 Corinthians 13 to the Corinthians, when he finally starts to describe what love is, the first thing he says is, love is patient. And so maybe God has put someone in your life that you're trying to help grow with him, and they're very, very frustrating. They're taking 4 steps forward, 3 steps back. And maybe part of you is just like, you know what? I'm tired of this. Remember, God is patient. He's loving. He cares about these people. And so we need to be able to take our time, because here's the thing. It's taken decades for us to wreck our lives. God's not going to just change that in a few years. It takes time. And so in the same way that Paul was patient instructing the Corinthian believers, we should be patient with the people that God has put into our lives. And then said goodbye to the brothers and sisters that went to nearby Cenchrea. And there you have Acts chapter 18. Yes, Lord, thanks for Paul's example. Thanks for what we can glean from these passages that we've been studying over the last quarter. And I pray that we would just stand out as different, Lord. I pray that people would recognize that we are people that are just filled with love, that we're people who are people of integrity, that we're honest, that we're hardworking, that we're, you know, not like everybody else who just backbite all of their coworkers. And I pray that that would just lead people to just wonder what drives us, what motivates us, what causes us to be this way, and that it will create an opportunity for us to be able to share about you and give you the credit and glory that you're the one who's changed our lives and that the message of the gospel is the thing that is ultimately transforming us into the person that we are. And so I pray, God, that we can be bold, not only in our faith, but also in our actions as well, loving people in a way that is just different than what we see in this world. And we pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.